Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you for joining us once again as we continue to pour through the big old monster box of baseball cards. The card stacks are getting thinner and thinner, as pretty much at this point in time, I kept star cards, rookie cards, and got rid of the rest. But we've got some real dandies in here, including our random pull today from the 1990 score set, which we will look at in depth. David Boomer Wells, quite possibly the last guy you would expect to amass 239 wins in his major league career. I've got to check out, does he have more wins than weight? He was a big boy, David Wells. Actually, officially, he was listed at 187, but after a random Tuesday night of cheeseburgers and Miller Lights, I'm sure that number was slightly inflated later on in his career. We'll talk about Wells and the nice bounce back from the score people with the 1990 set in just a little bit. First, let's talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. As always, you are welcome to chime in at any time at Wax and Gum Stains, and we certainly encourage you to share that Twitter feed with your friends, people who once collected and like to look back at their old cards, or people who still do collect now. We not only talk about our podcast and some of the players that are in the podcast, but we also talk about the hobby just in general, and we get some great stories along the way, including a nice little picture here from iWatch VHS, one of our followers, ran across these today in a box. He's posted a picture of a Ziploc bag. I can only see two of the packs here. I do see there's a third one, but I can't quite see what the third one is. But a 1990 Topps and a 1991 Topps wax pack. I hope those aren't hermetically sealed because they're worth only about 30 cents a pop. But two of my favorite underrated sets from this era, the early 90s. Always nice when you find stuff like that, isn't it? Yeah, so what if each card is worth a half penny in today's market? The oversaturated late 80s and early 90s. But regardless, it's always fun to find these and rip through them. And even if your one big card is worth 85 cents, you're like, yeah, I got that 1990 Fleer Gary Sheffield card. Again, I'll add it to the 18 others that I have in my big old monster box here. But again, thanks to iWatch VHS for sharing that. And you're always welcome to share stuff like that on our feed at any time. Now, let's talk a little bit about our previous podcast, which was about the 1990 Bowman set. A couple of comments from our friends here, including the one that I referenced in that podcast from Armwood High School, former teacher Bruce Burnham. Former teacher, always big booster of the Armwood Hawks, Bruce Burnham. I mentioned that he was in that podcast because he was the one teacher, and I still remember this 24 years later, the day that Paul O'Neill got traded. Mr. Burnham was a big Cincinnati Reds fan, and he came into my classroom and went, ah, that's a terrible trade. He just really ripped them for sending Paul O'Neill and a minor leaguer to the Yankees for Roberto Kelly. And of course, all these years later, you can look back at it and go, oh, yeah, you know, Mr. Burnham was right. So he chimes in, can't believe you remember that. Really a terrible trade for my Reds. Thanks. I don't know if that's a sarcastic thanks. Like, gee, thanks for bringing that up again, Salmon. Peter Steinberg, great podcast today, Matt. Well, thank you very much, Peter. Appreciate the comments. Ben Adams says, I was so put off by 89 Bowman, I just couldn't like 90 Bowman. Well, to each their own. But again, I encourage you, if you didn't like 89 Bowman simply because the size of the cards were too big, you know, they were a quarter of an inch taller than the standard baseball cards in 1989. Well, 1990, I think, is what the 89 Bowman was supposed to be, a very simple, plain, albeit, but somewhat forward-thinking card, especially when you get to the card back. Now, we do have some controversy when we look at the back of the card. Tim Murray says, Bowman was so edgy with the team-by-team stat breakdown, and I agree with you, Tim. I've always liked the team-by-team statistical breakdown, not only for the previous year, but for the player's entire career. You could see which team he had an advantage over. But our good friends at Baseball Card Back still do not like the backs of the Bowman cards, even though I think the 90 Bowmans were better than the 89 Bowmans. You can probably guess where I stand on these. Don't like them fronts or backs. Give me Donruss 5 years of stats any day. Now, that's the one that I don't like. I never liked Donruss just sticking with 5 years of stats. I mean, if you're Nolan Ryan and you had, you know, in 1990, for an example, you know, you had 24 years of professional baseball service, how can you have it to boil down to 5 years? Come on. At least give me some splits here. You know, give me team by team. Let me know which team Nolan Ryan dominated the year before. Well, I'll see if I have a 1990 Bowman, Nolan Ryan, see if I can figure that out. Now, I mentioned the bad trade for the Cincinnati Reds back in 1992, Paul O'Neill for Roberto Kelly. And I pondered this in the last podcast. I said, is this the worst trade for the Cincinnati Reds? Because when you first say worst trade in Reds history, probably 90% of the people you ask would say Frank Robinson to the Orioles. But still, you know, Paul O'Neill, you didn't get much back in Roberto Kelly. And so, you know, I put it up. I'm still kind of tossed on it. It's 50-50. You know, that's what I'm thinking. It's, I don't know, it depends on my mood. Either the Frank Robinson trade was worse or the Paul O'Neill trade was worse. So we asked over the weekend, tell us your favorite baseball team's worst trade in franchise history. And we've got some real doozies here, some that I even forgot about. Let's start off with Joey W. Some bad ones in my Braves history, but Justice and Grissom for Lofton and Embry the worst. Yeah, that's probably up there. Although, Joey, to be fair, I'm sure if we look through the record books in the 1970s, there were probably some really bad trades. Nothing just pops out at me right now, but I'd be willing to bet there's one deep in the archives that where you go, ugh. Now, not the 70s, but the 80s. Brett Butler trade was bad, too. That, of course, Brett Butler going to Cleveland in the early 80s. Yeah, they probably could have used him all those years later. Let's see, who else checking in here? Doug Miles, adding Ryan Sandberg as a throw-in to the Larry Boa for Ivan de Jesus swap between Phillies and Cubs in 1982. Yes, that is right up there. That was one where, you know, the throw-in, oh yeah, here, have this young second baseman. We'll take Ivan de Jesus. And de Jesus wasn't a bad shortstop, but he wasn't Ryan Sandberg, that's for sure. So, yeah, the Phillies certainly whiffed on that one there. Thanks for bringing up that one, Doug. Let's see, Trading Card Podcast. It's not a trade, but it haunts me every day. The Pirates passed on Manny Machado in the draft a few years ago. That's a pretty good one. Manny Machado picked third overall by the Orioles in 2010. The Pirates, who had the second pick, went with Jameson Taillon, a right-handed pitcher who actually made his Major League debut last year. Yeah, not quite Manny Machado, but it's always fun to do shoulda, woulda, coulda with drafts. Trust me, as a Rays fan, we did this a lot during the Chuck Lamar days back in the early 2000s. Gee, instead of Dwan Brazelton, we could have had, oh yeah, oh, Buster Posey was available, and yeah, we ended up with this guy. Yeah, it's tough. But, you know, you look at the 2010 draft, and you see guys like Matt Harvey. You see Chris Sale is on there as well. Christian Yelich, who is certainly doing very well with the Marlins nowadays. You know, there's Noah Syndergaard. I mean, there's a whole lot of shoulda, woulda, coulda that you could do when you look back at drafts. But you got to give the Pirates a little bit of a break, perhaps. I mean, with that second pick, you're feeling pretty good about whoever's falling in line there. But, yeah, they kind of whiffed on there, even though Taillon did finally make it to the majors. It's not like he's a total bust. But, yeah, not a trade, but certainly a, I don't want to say buyer's remorse, but, yeah, I can completely understand Trading Card Podcast, how you'd be kind of scratching your head going, wait a minute, why did we go with Taillon instead of Machado? We couldn't have used him. Completely understand. Tim Murray, another comment in regards to this particular topic. White Sox trade a young Bobby Bonilla for Jose De Leon. That might be one of the worst of the decade in the 1980s. Never mind, just in White Sox team history. Sean Graney, Seattle Pilots trade for Lou Piniella, or they traded Lou Piniella to the Royals for Steve Whitaker and John Gelnar. Piniella later would become Rookie of the Year. Now, that's true, but remember, the Royals would give up on Lou Piniella as well. He and Ken Wright went to the Yankees for Lindy McDaniel. So here's a former Rookie of the Year as the Royals are starting to ascend in the mid-70s. This was after the 73 season, and we all know what Lou Piniella was able to do for the Yankees in the late 70s. By the way, Lou Piniella, I don't think he's the only manager, but he might be one of two managers who have actually been traded, as he was traded by the Mariners to the Rays, of course, back then the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, for outfielder Randy Wynn. Yeah, that was the one star player the Rays had back in 2002. Randy Wynn, for a manager they hoped would get them over the hump, and he certainly didn't. Now, let's not also fault the Seattle Pilots here, as he was drafted in the expansion draft in 1969, and as you mentioned, was traded to Kansas City right before the 69 season. But Lou bounced around quite a bit. He was drafted by the Washington Senators in 1962, traded to Baltimore for a player to be named later. And that player to be named later was Buster Narum, a great name in baseball history. Baltimore then moved him to Cleveland for Cam Carrion. And then the Indians kept him exposed for the expansion draft, again, heading into the 1969 season. So you can rip the Seattle Pilots, who made numerous mistakes in their one and only season in Seattle, one being moving a young star like Lou Piniella. But the Washington Senators missed out. The Baltimore Orioles missed out. The Cleveland Indians missed out as well. So it's not just on the Pilots. Go, go, you Pilots. No, it's a number of teams that totally missed the boat on the type of player that Lou Piniella would eventually turn into. Great historic trade there, Sean Graney. Ben Adams, again, a bad trade that worked out for his team. He's a Cardinals fan, by the way. The trade for the Wizard. Now, this was another one of those trades, kind of in the line of Sandberg and Boa for DeJesus. At first, it looked like it was pretty even, but as time went on, it clearly favored one other team. This was in 1982 when the Cardinals and Padres did a trade where it was Ozzie Smith going to St. Louis for Gary Templeton. And Gary Templeton was not a bad player at all. This was shortstop for shortstop. And Templeton had a few good years in St. Louis. So again, on the surface at the time, it looks like a deal that favors both teams. You know, it's one of those trades that goes down where you go, oh yeah, that's a win-win there. Well, of course, Ozzie Smith being the great player that he was, and you know, helping the Cardinals win a World Series in 1982 and helping them get to the World Series in 85 and 87 and just having that phenomenal career, you put it up against Templeton, it's just like, yeah, I think the Cardinals won that one. And again, Templeton was a very good player. You know, he hit 271 his whole career. He was an all-star, a silver slugger, and this is in San Diego as well. So even though he was a good player, you go up straight head-to-head with Ozzie Smith, it doesn't really even out. A few more here on the worst trades in team history. And I love these, by the way. Thank you so much for sending these in. The Bully Bob Haas, Jeff Bagwell for Larry Anderson still stings. Yeah, I think the Red Sox might have had a World Series championship before 2004 had that trade not gone down. Wax Pack 916, I was just about to mention John Smoltz for Doyle Alexander or Bagwell for Anderson. Well, we've got the Bagwell for Anderson, and I'm sure you were prompted by our picture of a young John Smoltz, the Michigan native, wearing a Tigers uniform. It's probably a spring training shot in maybe 1987. I don't know where I found this, but I found that picture. Yeah, that's one of the legendary trades. Once the Braves started winning left and right in the 1990s, boy, that move for Doyle Alexander by the Tigers in the 87 playoff stretch, yeah, that one kind of hurts. And then Chris Rawls will wrap up this topic. He's got some very interesting trades here, some notable historic ones. Joe Morgan to Cincinnati for May and Helms back in 71 from the Houston Astros. Yep. Mike Cuellar to Baltimore for Kurt Bleffery. Yep, Cuellar had two or three really solid seasons there. One of the four 20-game winners for Baltimore back in 71. Schilling to Philadelphia for Grimsley. Yes, that's another one. You know, we did the podcast. It was the 88 Tops podcast about Glenn Davis. It might be the worst trade in Baltimore Orioles history, and that's arguably true for Pete Harnish, Curt Schilling, and Steve Finley. All three players had very good careers. Well, the trade from Houston to Philadelphia Grimsley for Schilling, that certainly didn't play into the Astros' favor. That was in 1992. Also, Ken Caminiti and Steve Finley to San Diego. I think you're a Houston fan, aren't you, Chris? You've really got a lot of regret here with the Astros. And he continues, although Lofton to Cleveland is right up there. Yes, that was Kenny Lofton for Taubensee, if I remember correctly. Imagine late 90s Stros with Lofton, Finley, Caminiti, and Schilling. Well, imagine too, Chris, had the Astros been able to keep together not just those players that you mentioned, but Doug Drabeck when he had his homecoming in the mid-90s. Imagine, too, when they added Randy Johnson in a trade, I think in 98, I think was when the trade was done. Let's see, you had Biggio, you had Bagwell. Yeah, you could have had a team. You know, the Astros had some decent teams in the mid to late 90s, but you could have had some outstanding teams if they were able to make it all work, but for one reason or another, they weren't able to. And I'll add my two cents here, again, as a Tampa Bay Rays fan. Now, I was a Blue Jays fan as a kid. This was before the Rays were even born. And I was trying to rack my brain. I'm like, okay, worst trade in Blue Jays history. And when I was a kid, I couldn't remember any truly awful trades. So I decided to scrub that. And I said, okay, let me focus on now. The team I like now, the team I've liked ever since I moved back here in 1999, the Tampa Bay Rays. And the first trade that I can think of was one of the first deals ever made. Chuck Lamar. Yes, sir. He used to say that a lot. So, Chuck, you got a lot of prospects in your system. Oh, yes, sir. One of the earliest moves that the team made after the expansion draft, they drafted Bobby Abreu, and the Rays traded him to Philadelphia for Kevin Stocker. Now, on the surface, okay, hey, we need a veteran infielder and a guy who can play on turf to boot. And certainly, if you could play on the infield, that rocky parking lot-like infield in Veterans Stadium, well, you know, what's playing on AstroTurf in St. Petersburg any different? So you can understand, okay, well, we're going to move this guy for this need. But all you have to do is look at the career stats of Bobby Abreu, who had a phenomenal stretch of about 8 or 10 years shortly after that trade. And Kevin Stocker, who was clearly going down as soon as the Rays acquired him, that might be the worst trade in Rays history. Although that can be in doubt because, well, there's still some questionable deals that they're making. They've made a few, all in the name, allegedly, of trying to save some money. But that one was the first one that came to mind. There have been many over the years. You know, the Rays acquiring Ben Grieve. Oh, that guy was a slug. Sean Burroughs, there was another one. I mentioned the Dewan Brazelton draft selection. And, of course, Brazelton was traded for Burroughs. There's a whole lot of other trades that the team has made. But the one that pretty much set the tone for the franchise 20 years ago, or almost 20 years ago, drafting Bobby Abreu in the expansion draft from Houston. There's another one there, Chris. Another player had the Astros just hung on to him. Drafting Bobby Abreu from the Astros and then moving him to Philadelphia for Kevin Stocker. Ay, 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 ay. All right, thanks again for all the comments on wax and gum stains, our Twitter feed for the Wax Ecstatic podcast. If you have more bad trades, the worst trade in your favorite team's history, posted up there. I'm pretty sure we'll get to a few more in our next podcast. Now, let's actually get to the player in this podcast. Normally, I talk about the card and then the player, but David Wells is quite the work of art here. That is, if the work of art was sculpted out of butter, that would be David Wells. As Big Boomer Wells, what an interesting career for this guy. And I, of course, as a Blue Jays fan, as a kid, remember him. He was a relief pitcher back in his early days in Toronto. So this was a pretty good transition for him. And it would turn out to be a very lucrative one because once he became a regular starter, and it wouldn't happen until Detroit in 1994, this guy was able to put together a very lengthy, albeit not really spectacular career, but a lot of people remember him more for his personality, his attitude, his emotional outburst, and of course, his love for the booze. And we'll get through all the numbers here for David Wells in just a moment. But I have to start with this story. And this is a story that's been shared publicly before, so I'm hoping I'm not getting into any trouble here. But a good friend of mine, I won't mention his name, He was a sports reporter in Toronto throughout much of the late 80s and early 90s. And he told me the story how one day he's in Skydome, or Rogers Center as it is now. He's in Skydome, and I think the Blue Jays were playing the Tigers. It was a Sunday afternoon, so it's a 1 o'clock first pitch, or 1:10, you know, whatever the technical start time is. So he's in the locker room at 11, 11:30 in the morning, and one of the clubhouse attendants says, "Hey, come here. I got to show you something." So my friend walks over, and the clubhouse attendant opens up a door into this little equipment room. And there, face down on a couch, with a bucket of vomit next to him, is David Wells. David Wells was the starting pitcher that afternoon. So you talk about a scoop. Well, looks like it might be a short outing for Mr. Wells today. Sure enough, inning and two-thirds, he gives up 6 runs, gets the hook. Probably went home and swallowed a few aspirin, but that pretty much sums up the career of David Wells. Certainly not only on the field, but off the field, as he was best known for his partying ways. And in fact, he even admitted the day that he pitched a perfect game for the Yankees. And he almost pitched 2 perfect games in his career. But the day he pitched a perfect game, that was May 17th, 1998, the 15th perfect game in baseball history, he shuts out Minnesota 4-0. He admitted that he was hungover that day. So unlike that day in Toronto, where he was blitzed going into the game, at least he had cleaned himself up just a little bit. But he pitched the perfect game May 17th, 1998, nearly got his second perfect game that year, September 1st, 1998, against Oakland. And the first hit that he allowed came in the 7th inning with 2 outs. So, you know, he went quite the way there. But, David Wells, known for his issues off the field. But on the field, he was a decent but not great pitcher, at least depending on which statistic you look at. Now, we'll go through his trade timeline a little bit. But here is a guy who had a career earned run average of 4.13. Okay, that's kind of worse than Jack Morris. And I've said Jack Morris should be in the Hall of Fame. David Wells, no, he shouldn't be. But 4.13. Let's say he was a ground ball pitcher because he allowed 3,635 hits over 3,439 innings. So a hit an inning. Now I say, let's say he was a ground ball pitcher, because he did also give up an average of 24 home runs a season, 407 home runs over a 21-year career. But that's the key, a 21-year career. This guy hung around not only because he was left-handed, and of course left-handed pitchers typically have a longer life term than right-handed pitchers, unless you're dominant, but if you could throw junk left-handed, you can still find a team out there that'll sign you. So not only because he was left-handed, but he also, when he was dialed in, and I don't know if that's sober or not, but when he was dialed in, this guy could flat out dominate. Strikeout to walk ratio, 3-1. 2,201 strikeouts to 719 walks. It's pretty darn impressive. And along the way, even though David Wells had a bad attitude, was over-emotional, was drunk a lot of the time, 239 wins. This guy was a 3-time All-Star. Twice he finished 3rd in Cy Young Award voting. He was a 20-game winner in his second stint with the Toronto Blue Jays. That was back in 2000. He went 20-8 despite a 4.11 earned run average and giving up a league-leading 266 hits in 229 2/3 innings. This guy, for the most part, even against all odds, somehow got it done. And yes, he was a world champion. Won a World Series in 1992 with the Jays, mostly in relief. He appeared in 4 games, 4 1/3 innings. And then as a starter in 1998 with the Yankees against the San Diego Padres. But the Yankees didn't win the World Series solely on his effort, as the one game he pitched against the Padres, he lasted 7 innings, gave up 7 hits, 5 earned runs, an earned run average of 6.43, yet the Yankees still swept the Padres in that series, So I think that goes to show you how really good the 98 Yankees were. But, you know, here's a guy who was a world champion, won 239 games, had that tremendous strikeout-to-walk ratio, and somehow made it through 21 years despite some off-field issues. Wells was drafted by the Blue Jays in the second round of the 1982 amateur draft, eventually made his way to the major leagues in 1987, again, primarily as a relief pitcher. But his attitude and his habits, the Blue Jays didn't like it, so they let him go after the 1993 season. He signs as a free agent with the Tigers and sticks around with them for a couple of seasons, becomes a starting pitcher. The Tigers send him to Cincinnati in a trade, along with C.J. Nitkowski, for Mark Lewis. And then the Reds would send him along to Baltimore after the 95 season for Curtis Goodwin. So you're thinking, wow, David Wells got traded for these guys? Well, again, he hadn't quite elevated himself to stardom just yet. That would happen with the Yankees. And again, more because of the strength of the Yankee team, even though Wells did have some good games and some halfway decent seasons with the Yankees. Now, he was part of a big trade after winning the World Series in 1998. He, along with Homer Bush, another great baseball name. Remember, he had that weird batting stance, too? So he and Bush and Graham Lloyd went to Toronto for Roger Clemens. Bet you forgot, Roger Clemens actually pitched in Toronto for a few years. The Red Sox gave up on him. Yeah, he resurrected his career in Toronto before winning a couple of World Series with the Yankees in 2000 and 2001. Speaking of 2001, the Blue Jays give up on Wells again, send him to Chicago for Mike Williams, Kevin Byrne, Brian Simmons, and Mike Soroka. I think the White Sox got the better of that deal. And then through numerous free agent deals, Wells just bounces around. He goes back to the Yankees. He goes to San Diego. He goes to the Boston Red Sox after they win the World Series in 2004. One more trade to be made as he's sent back to San Diego for a player to be named later. That would be George Gutierrez. And then, again, free agency deals left and right. You know, going back to San Diego, going to Los Angeles. He was originally from Torrance, California, so he's from the San Diego area. So he would stay in Southern California for the final few years of his career, wrapping up his career officially in September of 2007 with the LA Dodgers. And again, this is a guy. Let me look through his stats here. He had one season of an earned run average under 3. He had a 2.40, and this is in relief, in 1989 with the Blue Jays. As a starter, so we're looking at 1993 and on, his lowest earned run average was a 3.24. This was in 1995, splitting time between Detroit and Cincinnati at the age of 32. Other than that, this guy consistently had an earned run average typically around 4. But again, as a lefty, he was able to get enough stuff out there, and he didn't leave it hanging over the plate. He still had enough gas to blast it by some guys, and like I said, managed to get 239 wins and quite a few strikeouts and another World Series in his career. But David Wells, ever since then, is more of a legendary player, not necessarily for what he did on the field, but certainly off the field. When his career ended, he moved on to broadcasting, doing some postseason games for TBS. He also became a host of The Cheap Seats on FoxSports.com. And he's moved on to coaching. He has become an assistant coach at his alma mater, Point Loma High School. And also, he was the head baseball coach there, and they renamed the stadium there, or the ball field, I should say, in honor of him. David Wells Field went through a $2 million renovation. It was underwritten by the San Diego Unified School District and Wells. So even though he's known for his childlike antics, he's helping the children in San Diego at his alma mater progress, hopefully to the major league. So some good stuff there. Now, some good stuff, too, from the Score Company in 1990. After that absolute turd of a set in 1989, they finally put together something pretty nice in 1990. And I joked in the last podcast how they were the Hammer Pants cards, or the more I look at them, the In Living Color cards. Remember that show, In Living Color? Jim Carrey got his big break there. David Alan Grier, Jamie Foxx, of course, the Wayans brothers were big stars on that show. Yeah, this definitely screams 1990. The big thing about this particular card set is that it got back to the color that scorecards were quite popular with showcasing. And you get to see the color really well in the David Wells card. So let's take a look at the front of the David Wells card. You look at the frame here, you've got a dark blue frame, which is rather appropriate with the Blue Jays, although the frame colors didn't necessarily match the team colors. It just happens to in this case, as you had kind of the Skittles effect all over again. Remember 1988 when Score made their first release, you had red and yellow and orange and green and blue. You had the exact same thing in 1990. So after a disastrous 89 campaign, Score coming out with one of the many things that worked in the 88 set. And another thing that worked was the photography, really good photography in the 1990 Score set. And I love this picture of David Wells, too. Here he is just finishing his follow-through, teetering, defying physics and the laws of gravity as he's standing on one leg and wearing the new Blue Jay road uniforms. This was the first year, 1989, of course, where the Blue Jays got rid of the powder blues and went with that rather sharp gray and blue road uni, which they have resurrected over the last few years. They're using that once again. So you've got the dark blue border, the gold border in between, and that nice picture taking up most of the real estate up front, the rather sharp logo, almost like a high-res team logo in the lower right-hand corner. And you know I'm a big fan of baseball logos. Put them anywhere you can, and Score did that to a perfection in 1990. And then the In Living Color look, the MC Hammer pants look here, the rather I'm from 1990 look that you see here in Wells' name at the bottom. The first letter of the player's first and last name were in that box that kind of jumped out right at you. And that happened with all cards in the Score set. And it's a rather unique, I mean, goofy, but a rather unique and memorable and kind of cool way of separating itself from other cards in 1990, although Topps would certainly try to fit into some Hammer pants that year with their design. Now you flip the card over and oops, speaking of flipped over, we've got an inverted photograph. Yeah, this is the uncorrected error. I don't recall if there was a big difference between the uncorrected error and the error version, but there were two versions of this card, number 491, as the Wells picture did get flipped back over the way it was supposed to. But much like you saw in 88 and 89, this is the one thing that Score had year after year that really worked. Even though the 89 fronts were bad, the backs were good, you saw the exact same thing here. The player photo normally in the correct position. In the upper left-hand corner, you've got the card number, the Score logo, the player name, and then the personal information on the right there. And there it lists him at 225 pounds. That's a little more realistic than the 187 I saw listed. And then you've got his career stats, professional pitching record, none of that Donruss stuff. Let's go ahead and mention some minor league stats as well. And then the full scouting report, which I loved with these early releases from Score. Not just stats, not just did you know, not just a little trivia thing, but some really interesting scouting report style notes. Including in the case of David Wells, if you look at that second paragraph here, the second half of the second paragraph, I should say, he had elbow surgery in 1985, so that derailed his career by 1 year, but he came back as a reliever and was basically turned into a reliever. But again, the Tigers, liking what he was able to do, put him back into a starting rotation position in 1993 when they picked him up as a free agent. So a very interesting little note there that not necessarily any other card could throw in there because of space reasons or whatever the case may be. But some interesting facts, and Score was able to do that with that scouting report style of a baseball card back. 704 cards in this set. Some very memorable cards in the set. Not only did you have some quality rookie cards, of course, Frank Thomas was the big one, and that's one of the cards that still carries quite a bit of value to it. If you get it, I've seen PSA 8s or 9s, you know, they'll put them, you know, in the $30 area. Obviously, if you don't have it graded and you just have a standard Frank Thomas card, it's probably a $2 or $3 card, but still, compared to a lot of other cards released in 1990, that was still a pretty decent value for any card released that year. A couple of other notable cards in this set. One, Eric Lindros, recently inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in Toronto. Well, before he had his legendary holdout with the Quebec Nordiques, and before his brains turned into pudding in an NHL career that was pockmarked by numerous concussions, he did try out, that's kind of a loose word, he did have a batting practice session with the Blue Jays. So there is a Toronto Blue Jays Eric Lindros baseball card, which doesn't quite have the aura of some of the Danny Ainge cards from the early 80s. Of course, Ainge, a utility infielder with the Blue Jays, and later a much more successful basketball player and coach. But still, it's kind of a neat card. Eric Lindros as a baseball player. And I've often thought that when Lindros threatened to sue former NHL referee Paul Stewart for criticizing him, I always thought that the Blue Jays should sue Eric Lindros for pretending to be a baseball player. But, you know, maybe that's my own idea. Now, the other interesting card from this set is the legendary Bo Jackson football baseball card. It's called a mashup. I think that's kind of a goofy term for it. But if you are somebody who follows one of our followers, and that would be Bean's Ball Card Blog, you've seen this picture because it's their avatar on Twitter. It is Bo wearing the shoulder pads, the football shoulder pads, and that's it. It's a shot of him from the torso up. So he's wearing the shoulder pads, but he's also got a baseball bat. He's kind of, you know, stretching his arms, you know, the bat's behind his neck, and he's just kind of stretching his arms out there. So that was a very legendary photograph, not just for that particular card, but I remember seeing posters, and this was all kind of part of the Bo Knows campaign going on with Nike back then. So a very neat card there from the score set, and one of the few that, again, still carries some value. If you find it, it's worth a few bucks. But I know on the back, you know, instead of any kind of stats or storyline, score just said Bo, and that was it. That's all you needed back in 1990. It was Bo. Bo Jackson was dominating the sports scene, and especially the sports marketing scene then. Yes, even before Deion Sanders did, Bo Jackson was just all over it. And even though his football career would basically end his baseball career right around this time, he was still just the dominant force in sports and sports marketing at the time. So a really neat set, one that, thanks to overproduction, is still readily available. I've seen wax boxes, you know, not including shipping, for around $12, $14. I've seen complete sets in the $20, $25 range. Again, very similar to a lot of sets that were released in 1990. But this is a really colorful, really well-done set. And if you can collate that whole set, who knows, maybe you get that Eric Lindros card, you get that Bo Jackson card, some really neat throwbacks to 1990 from a really neat set. And considering score was just an absolute mess in 89, even though they had the hammer pants on, even though they were auditioning for In Living Color here with this set, it is not only screaming 1990 at you, but it is screaming, we're better than what we were last year. And that's what I like about this set. Really cool set to look back on and one to collect. So you got a few extra bucks hanging around. You want to go buy a box or two. You could probably get two for 20 when it comes to the wax boxes, or I should say the polyurethane, because they have those flimsy plastic wrappers. But regardless, you could still get a pretty good deal on these sets, and at least a pretty colorful set out of it. I will say that. So 1990 score rebounding rather nicely from what they produced in 1989. And the same can be said for Fleer. Fleer had an okay set that I've grown to like over the years in 1989. But 1990, I loved it when it came out. And even though it is still vastly drowning us in overproduction 26 years later, I still love it now. We're going to take a look at the 1990 Fleer set in our random pull in our next podcast. They'll be coming your way this Friday. So we'll stuff ourselves with turkey, and then we'll stuff ourselves with some overproduced baseball cards on our next Wax Ecstatic podcast. Have a happy and safe Thanksgiving. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. And once again, comment anytime about anything related to this hobby or our podcast at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks once again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic.